Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Live from Las Vegas, it's time for you to be Talking Movies with America's most award-winning film critic, John Barber.
You're being so gentle. I've heard you give reviews and you're so rough, you're saying.
How would you have evaluated your own work in some of the films that you did prior to The Longest Shot? I
mean, much better than you, my friend.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Hi again, and welcome to Talking Movies. I am just so thrilled and delighted to be doing this show, and especially, as I said before, with Don and Doug Newsome, who relocated in Texas. Fortunately, Doug, how are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you, John.
Well, you know, I didn't know it, but you mentioned to me a while ago that you and Don were born in Vancouver and then came to the United States. Is that right?
Indeed, we were. We actually grew up in the northern part of BC in the Chilcotin area, and then went down to the Vancouver area. Of course, waited 5 years to come to the U.S. and then landed right across the border in near Bellingham.
Well, you know, you have, and a number of people have commented on the fact that you have a really nice voice. And you also have a very good look, even though you still look like your brother. So when you came to the United States and then ended up in California, did you ever have any thoughts of becoming an actor?
It's interesting. I was actually invited on a couple of programs for my music, my singing, once as a contestant, not a contestant. I was a person who was supposed to pick three different dates to go on, and they did an interview of like a few thousand people, and they picked me. And then once was for, like, before Star Search, there was this kind of like, not a gong show program, but you had three star judges, and they ranked you, and the winner got selected. Both times I moved right before I could actually do the taping of these things. So those would have been opportunities. I'd been offered a couple of times other opportunities, but life seemed to get in the way.
Well, listen, what was it? Was John Lennon said, life is what happens while you're making plans. But you know, what I like to do, I'm stunned to hear that you could sing, because Sarita, as you know, is a singer, and I just love singers. Next to writers, they're the performers I admire the most. So somewhere down the line, we're going to play something that you sang. You know, when I came down to Los Angeles the first time, of course, I wanted to be an actor, but that didn't work out. But I ended up being a critic. And it's funny, because once I got on NBC for 5 years and then 10 years at Los Angeles Magazine, I was offered a lot of jobs as an actor. And of course, I turned everyone down because I said it was a conflict of interest. What a worn out old adage that is now. It's so meaningless in America today, a conflict of interest. But I turned down a good part in Rocky. And the movie that I turned down that I was really sorry I did was The Parallax View. Alan J. Pakula, I'd met absolutely fabulous producer I'd met in the mailroom, and we were lifelong friends until he was killed by an accident in New York City, and he offered me the job as a senator, and I passed on that. But you know what? One time I did go out of my way to ask somebody who was famous for a part in a sitcom, because I love it. You remember the sitcom MASH?
Oh, how can I forget that? I think the whole world knows it.
Exactly. And the creator of it was a guy named, co-creator, a guy named Larry Gelpart. Well, I loved the show, and I loved Mike Farrell in it. I loved Alan Alda, and I thought, God, I would love to be able to work with these guys. So I called Larry Gelpart, and I said, hey, I hate to say this. I'm turning down parts. But I think he'd recently hired McLean Stevenson because somebody had left the show. If anybody else ever leaves the show, Larry, can I come and audition? And he said, John, you will never have to audition for me. I will hire you the next opening. But the next opening never came. So unfortunately, I never got to meet and perform with Mike Farrell. And Mike Farrell was my favorite on the show. He ended up writing a number of them and directing a number of them and became so successful. He ended up being a producer of a terrific movie called Patch Adams with Robin Williams. Oh, I never got to work with him. But today on Talking Movies, I get the pleasure to be talking to him. So here he is, Mike Farrell. Anyway, Mike, I can't thank you enough for being here. And while we were getting the technical stuff figured out, you made some comment about wanting to dress a little nicer. Okay. Well, to me, you look great because you're in front of a bookcase. But you'll see at the opening of our show, you have Frank Sinatra introducing me when he hosted The Tonight Show, and I come out in a tuxedo. And I did that show for 4.5 years. I was Francis's private writer. And I did that show while I was also hosting and co-producing Real People. And this is one of the suits from Real People. And and to this day, I did that in 1977. And to this day, they all fit me. But guess what's a little loose now?
What?
The skin. After all these years, and I'm wearing the suit sort of accidentally because I was lucky enough. My first guest, I'm sure you're a monster fan of TCM and has probably been a guest on the show. I think that Eddie Muller, who is the Noir Alley host on Saturday nights on TCM, is by far the most literate, articulate, well-dressed human left in all of television.
Oh, isn't that good?
He always wears a suit and a tie. So he agreed to launch our show and be our first guest. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't talk to him unless I wear a suit and tie. So that's why I put this on. And I have such enormous respect for you and the other people that have already committed to the show. I'm going to continue to wear the suit and the tie. It just feels so good. Now, I talked to a guy, Eddie Muller, who just talked beautifully about the films that he saw and the films that he saved. But now I get to talk to somebody who actually appeared in them and wrote them and directed them and produced them. And if I gave a list of all your unbelievable credits, the interview time is over. So, like a movie, we must start at the beginning. And in the beginning, I need to know something about where you were born, your mother and father, your siblings, and you were in the late 40s. You were still probably old enough to be going to the movies before the impact of television.
Yeah.
And so I want to know a little about the first movies that you saw and remember and had an impact on you. But start with your mother and father.
Well, my mom and dad met in Minnesota, and she lived in South St. Paul. He lived in Rosemont, and they married there. They had three kids there: my older sister Sally, myself, and my younger brother Jim. they moved to California when they were, when I was two. So that would have been about 41. And my sister Kathleen was born in about 44, I guess. And my mom and dad were, my dad was a, they're both smart folks. They're both, you know, through high school, I suppose, educated, but never, not college educated. They were depression survivors. My mother always remembers and reminded us that getting an apple in your stocking at Christmas was a big help.
What did your father do?
A number of things. His dad was a traveling salesman who it was a fighting family. His dad was a traveling salesman who died in a fight, as the story goes. My dad was a number of things in Minnesota. He worked in the stockyards in South St. Paul. He worked as a deputy sheriff. He worked as a number of things, but he didn't have a career in the sense of a professional. And his younger brother, Matt, who skated with Sonya Henie. And,
oh, my gosh, how interesting.
Yeah, and came out to California with her on tour and told my dad, you know, the streets in California are made of gold and that this is the place where you can make a living. And so he moved the family.
Did he become a policeman in L.A.? What did he do?
I'm not sure how he began. But he began working construction, and he became a carpenter and got in the union and worked in the studios. He was a carpenter in the studios for many years.
Now, did that have any influence on you at all when you eventually decided to become an actor?
Of course. Just being raised in Hollywood, Natalie Wood was in my... Natasha Gurdon was her name at the time, in my second grade.
Oh, my gosh. How interesting. Okay,
it was very much Hollywood-oriented.
And when I mentioned late 40s about movies, you said yes very quickly. So tell me about some of the early movies. I mean, did you have to go and see a Sonya Henie movie? What were the first movies that might have had an impact on you, either emotionally or intellectually?
Oh, I'm trying. Since you mentioned it, I'm trying to think of it. Going to the movies was a big deal. You would take the streetcar on Santa Monica Boulevard up to the Carmel, and it would cost 10 cents to get into the theater. And there's a double feature, maybe a cartoon and a newsreel. So I remember the Three Musketeers. I remember some of the classics that of the time. But I was a kid. I was young, kind of yearning, and really just living the ecstasy of enjoying going away into whatever world was presented me on the screen.
Oh, how wonderful. Now, you said you were in class with Natalie Wood. Where did you go to? You went to Hollywood High School.
I did, but Natalie and I were in West Hollywood Grammar School together.
Oh, okay. Now you go. So your education in Hollywood High School, you're a young teenager.
Yeah.
What were your sort of ambitions, or did you have any? I mean, did you want to be a baseball player? Did you want to be? What did you want to do when you were in high school?
John, my older sister Sal brought movie magazines home, and I saw in movie magazines that young people, some of them were actors. They got a lot of attention danced on them. They got what I assumed was love and respect and all those good things. And you know, I was fighting for. How do you have my dad pay attention to me? And
So that almost sounds sad.
The dream of becoming an actor was born in me very, very early. So I went up, through Bancroft Junior High and Hollywood High School. And at Hollywood, I was with Ricky Nelson and John, his brother, John. and his brother David, and with John Law, and with
my goodness, how interesting!
I remember who a young woman who was in anyway, but actors, a lot of actors, and I thought that would be the life, you know. But the problem for me was I was a terribly shy kid, and I couldn't even get up in speech class to make a speech. I was terrified of the idea. So we had John Engel was the drama teacher, a very famous guy later on, taught at UCLA and a number of other places. And they had this wonder, and they did these wonderful shows, and I just didn't have the guts to even go in and try out. I was terrified.
Well, you want to know something, Mike? I hate to say this because I strangely believe in serendipity. You are married to a fabulous singer and actress, Jelly Fabares. Just wonderful. I am married to a fabulous singer. But when you were in Hollywood High School in the 50s in day classes, I was in night classes at Hollywood High School.
Oh.
A drama teacher. Her name was Miss Strickland. And she was a very famous Hollywood actress with a beautiful voice. I mean, like Patricia Neal. And a fabulous teacher. And right across the aisle from me was a young guy about my age who resembled me a little bit. And in 3 weeks, like you, he would never get up to speak. He would never participate. If Miss Strickland said, please, would you get up and read this line? This is how he wouldn't even get up. The fourth week, while Miss Strickland was on stage giving a sample of how to read Cole, which was brilliant, this kid stood up, raised his hand, and she said, what do you want? And she says, and he said, Miss Strickland, you're a wonderful teacher, but this isn't for me. And he walked out.
Oh.
And he gave him the class, and we were all really, oh my God, that's really kind of sad. And then I didn't see him for a couple of years later, and he popped up in all these Roger Corman movies. It was Jack Nicholson. There are three actors to me. See, I came to the United States because I fell in love with movies.
Yeah.
I was semi-orphaned, so between the ages of 6 and 17 when I ran away to the United States. If I wasn't on a hockey rink or in a detention center or a library, I was in the theater by myself watching these double features, and I fell in love with Frank Capra. Uh-huh. And that's why I came and fell in love with this country and came here.
Yeah,
there are three actors who I have seen all of my life. It doesn't matter what they do, but you always like them. There's no likability about them, just as human beings. And those three are Jimmy Stewart, Dick Van Dyke, and Mike Farrell.
Oh.
So, I mean, it's impossible not to like you, and no matter, and you know, the things you've done. And I got it. Oh, I'm telling you, when I heard that you were in The Graduate, The Graduate, I put it on and I kept looking for you. So I'm because I know that one famous actor got started as a corpse in a movie. Sean Connery was a Navy expert in South Pacific.
Wow.
And, there was somebody else that I'm thinking of who James Garner. Garner was didn't have a speaking line on stage in Inherit the Wind. He was one of the jurors.
Wow.
And there you are. Tell us about, I mean, that couldn't have been your first job.
No, it was a very exciting job. Why are you kidding? I mean, I was in a movie with Dustin Hoffman.
It was his first film, so you didn't know how good this was going to be, except Anne Bancroft was just absolutely brilliant. And you were later in a film that her husband directed. Mel Brooks, Silent Movie. You played a cop in Silent Movie. I know all about you. Okay, so now, you know what? When you graduated from high school, I guess you didn't go to college.
No.
What did you do?
Joined the Marines.
You were the most unlikely Marine, even though you were so lovable in MASH. I mean, my wife said to me, oh, God, he's adorable. Okay, but I can't imagine an adorable human being a Marine. Why did you enlist in the Marines, and what was it like, and where were you stationed?
It was tough. I grew up with a buddy who, and we adored the Marines. We watched all the John Wayne movies, and we watched Webb be the DI, and we watched, you know, the Sands of Iwo Jima and Guadalcanal Diary and War, you know, Retreat Hell, Frank Lovejoy. It was... It was sort of the epitome of manhood, which was something that was very important to me. And I had always wanted to be accepted by my dad,
who was a
big, tough Irishman and very,
very
tough, you know, two-fisted. He used to come home from the bar at night and walk in the front door, slam it, and say, if the cops come, I'm not home.
That's funny. So when you were in the Marines, did you still think about acting at all?
Oh, you know, I dreamed about being an actor. But first of all, when I graduated from high school, college wasn't on the agenda. So I was going to be drafted. And I thought, I don't want to be drafted in the Army. I'm going to be a Marine. So I joined the Marines. And went, you know, through basic training, which is murder, and went through infantry training, which is worse. And
how long did you serve?
I joined for 2 years. I was shipped to Okinawa, where I was part of an Antos battalion. Antos is an unusable weapon. It was supposed to be an anti-tank weapon, but it had more mechanical problems than it had, but firepower. And I spent a little time in Japan, and then I came back to the States, and then I was discharged. And it was I won't say a lovely time, but I survived.
Did you gain any respect from your father for having served?
My dad died when I was 17, before I graduated from high school.
So
the idea, part of it was to prove something to him, I suppose, prove something to myself.
So now you're out on the street.
Yeah.
You're thinking about being an actor, and obviously you probably want to, since you don't want to get up in class and speak or do anything like that, in order to learn how to do it, you must have joined some kind of group or acting class or something. No.
A buddy of mine with whom I had joined the Marines was out, and I was driving a truck, delivering groceries to movie stars, feeling like I wanted to be them. One thing I will always remember is I was delivering to, now I'm going to blank on her name. I was going to say Dorothy Malone.
Oh my gosh.
I was delivering groceries to Dorothy Malone's house. I was in her kitchen and she walked in. And she was just as beautiful as you can imagine her to be. And I was staggered, and she was very sweet. And I was emptying out the groceries and, you know, doing my job and then about to leave. And she said, how are you? And what do you want to do as a career? And I said, God, I've always wanted to be an actor.
Oh, wow.
And she said, oh, yes, you should.
really? Yeah. Then you started to talk about your buddy who was with the Marines. Did he join an acting group together?
No, but he was at a gas station on Sunset Strip. He was working, and a guy was working with him, a fellow who'd come out from Eastern Canada. You'll recognize this, Prince Edward Island. He came all the way to the West Coast because he wanted to be an actor, and he was in an acting workshop, and he and I would talk about acting. And he said one day, Mike, you know, if you're really serious about being an actor, maybe you ought to do something about it. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I'm part of this actor's workshop, and you could come down here and you can sit with us and you can learn about scene study and you can learn about the craft, and you can, you know, if you really want to do it, you can learn how to do it. So
and,
I joined. That was Jeff Corey's workshop.
Oh, yes. He was very famous. One of the best. He was better than Stella Adler from what I understand.
Jeff was wonderful. And Jeff, of course, was blacklisted. A wonderful character actor, but blacklisted and had his career ruined. But he was a wonderful teacher, very gentle.
Oh, you know what? It's terrible to say. I'm really glad you mentioned blacklisted, because we're going to get in later on to some of the things that you do that help improve the world and society. And I'd like to find out where it came from. But, you know, when you were in acting class, was there an actor that you wanted to imitate or be like? Who was your favorite actor?
There was a beautiful girl.
I didn't say actress.
No, I know. No, there were a couple of actors I thought were interesting. Greg Mileevy was one of them. He became a character actor in the business. And he had some talent. Greg had some talent. Some of them were flat-footed like I was and just kind of didn't know what they were doing. Claudia Brack was this woman's name, and I thought, oh my God, she is just beyond belief in terms of how beautiful she was. And like so many young people in that workshop, she never went anywhere in the business.
Oh, how sad. How sad. Well, I'll tell you, quite honestly, when I first got into Hollywood, I was really, really interested in becoming an actor just like you. And I had the same problems with my father, et cetera. But, you know, when I see famous actors and actresses talking now, one of the things that really bothers me after spending decades in the business, I never hear them once mention their agent or their manager or somebody that helped them launch their careers. And I know from personal contact, there would have been no Woody Allen, there would have been no Harry Belafonte, and there might not have even been a Mike Nichols had it not been for Jack Rawlins, by far the very best manager in the business, at 100, is still alive, smoking cigars and betting on the horses. So with me, I got out of Miss Strickland's class and I went around looking for an agent, because I guess that's what you're supposed to do. And the couple of guys that I bumped into couldn't imagine me in movies, but they could imagine me in their apartment. Oops. Hang on. Maybe I can find some lady agents. So I tried them. They weren't interested in me as man or actor. And that's when I gave it up and decided to do stand-up comedy, because that I could do by myself. So I want to know, when you were in Jeff Corey's class, did they teach you the values of agents? And did you go hunting for jobs or agents first? And tell me some of those stories.
Well, sure. One story will interest you based on what you just said. I was driving a truck, as I told you, and Hollywood was, there were a lot of gay people in Hollywood at the time. And one of the things about, I used to get picked up periodically. If I wanted to go somewhere, I'd hitchhike. You know, I'd stick my thumb out, a car would stop. I'd get in, I'd go to wherever I wanted to go, and the driver would proposition me, and I'd say, no, thanks. And he'd say, okay, and out we'd go. One day I was walking home from my job driving a truck, and a guy in a Cadillac stopped and said, made some excuse about stopping, and then got up and said, oh, would you like a ride? And I said, sure, I'm just going down to Doheny. And he said, fun, that'd be fine. So I got in the car and we sat, and he gave me his card, and he said, I'm an agent, and I'm wondering if I like the way you look, perhaps you'd like to be interested in a career. I said, yeah, I'm actually tickled by the idea. And he said, well, give me a call. And his name was Henry Wilson.
Oh, my gosh. Infamous. Cab Hunter's agent, Rock Hudson's agent.
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And I called, and he invited me up to the office, and we talked. And he said, I'd like to invite you to to, I'd like to get some, set up an interview for you. I said, you know, I had done nothing. I knew nothing at that point about acting, but I was excited as hell, of course. And I said, well, okay. And he sent me to Columbia Studio to meet, and I'm trying to remember the name of the producer because he was really great. I sat down in front of this guy and he asked me about what I'd done. And I said, nothing. And he said, now, Henry sent you here. And I said, yes, that's right. And he said, do you know what that implies? And I said, no, I'm not sure I do. And he said, somebody who's represented by Henry, well, some particularly a young unknown by like yourself, it suggests that you're giving sexual favors to him and he's trying to do something for you in the business. And I think maybe it was Hal Wallace. I'm not sure.
Oh, wow.
I said, well, that's not the case. And he said, well, I can only tell you that that will be the implication of your relationship with him, whether or not that is in fact what's happening. And I said,
Hal was an excellent producer, and that was just outstanding advice. So I presume that
it was wonderful. And I went back to Henry and I said, look, this is what I'm coming to understand is that this suggests that you and I have some sort of sexual relationship. And he said, well, of course, that's a quid pro quo here. That's the way it is. And I said, not with me. And he said,
how old were you at the time to be so articulate and forthright and honest?
I was 19, 20.
Good for you. Now, okay, you haven't had a part yet.
No.
In Jeff Corey's class. So you had what was the very first thing you got as an actor that made you feel like, hey, I like this and maybe I can do something with it? What was it?
A group of us from the workshop put together a play. And I played, of all things, a Marine sergeant. Sergeant O'Hara in Rain.
Oh, and, my gosh.
And we mounted this production in Los Angeles at a little playhouse on La Cienega and invited, of course, the idea was you invite casting directors and people as well as agents to see your work. And I have to say, in all fairness, that I was just terrible. I was just awful in the show. But I was surrounded by good actors, and I guess I got through it. But a man named, a very, very nice man, Herman Zimmerman, contacted me after. He's an agent. And he said, look, I like the way you look. I think maybe you can do something. I'd like to try and set up some interviews for you. And I said, God, I would love that. And I love to tell this story. First interview he set up for me was for a movie with Fess Parker. And I went into the interview and they said, oh, you're not tall enough. So so I said, oh, okay, and I left. And the next interview he set up for me was a war movie, and I thought, oh, I've got a shot here. And, and it starred Audie Murphy, and they said, oh, you're much too tall.
Oh, that's funny. That is
the third. The third interview he set up for me was for the Red Skelton show, where when I went on the interview, they said, oh, you're exactly the right size to fit into the gorilla suit.
So, did you do it? Did you fit in the gorilla suit?
So I got the job as I walked into some scene with Red when I was in my gorilla suit. And then I also played an usher who was trying to give some people a seat or something. I've forgotten what the deal was. Oh. But I always loved that. I was too short for Fess Parker, for Audie Murphy.
You know who also was in a gorilla suit?
No.
Jack Lemmon.
Oh, really? Jack,
do you remember Ernie Kovacs?
Oh, of course.
Yes. Well, I did a documentary about his life called Ernie Kovacs, Television's Original Genius. And one of the guys I wanted to talk to, of course, was Jack Lemmon. And Jack told the story about being part of the Nairobi Trio, but he was a guy in the gorilla suit. And it's just amazing what you people all do now. But now you have to get a part. You get a part, Is it in a movie or is it in a television series? And what was the part?
Well, the first film job I got was a commercial. And it was a, you know, a television commercial where I did some spiel and was in a gas station, I remember. And I remember I started getting checks. I was getting checks. And with that, and at that time, I had recently gotten married. So we're talking 4 years later, I guess. I'd gotten married. I moved to Laguna Beach because the woman I married was a teacher in at Laguna Beach High School.
Wasn't her name Trudy or
Judy?
Judy, yes, I remember. Yeah, she was also an actress, too.
Well, she became an actress as well, yeah.
Remind me later because there is a sitcom in the story that you're about to tell. But anyway, keep going.
Okay, so we started doing plays in the famous Laguna Beach Playhouse. And that's where I learned really more about acting, other than the workshops I'd been in. Working on the stage, we did Mary Mary and Some Like It, not Some Like It, Thousand Clowns and every, you know, popular sitcom that you can imagine. And Judy and I co-starred in a number of them, and I starred in a number of them. And Harrison Ford worked there in a show. It became a real theater experience. And then I'd be going up into the Los Angeles and trying to, you know, do interviews. And finally, I had set up a business down there to pay the way. And finally, I gave it up and moved to Hollywood. And Judy stayed as a teacher in L.A. And it destroyed our marriage, of course.
Oh. But, and you had two children, I believe, right?
Not at that point. Oh. No. Yeah, thank heaven we didn't have children at that point. But at any rate, I started getting, you know, little jobs, little acting. I got a job in I Dream of Jeannie on the television show, and I got a job on the Monkees.
My gosh. And weren't you also in a Lassie episode?
Lassie, I was just going to say Lassie. Yeah. And, you know, it's one line. It's he went that away or.
Okay, now you're doing these little tiny things.
Yeah.
And it probably didn't make you feel like, gosh, I'm really successful. You know, and then you ended up later in The Graduate and you didn't have a line.
I did have a line. I don't think I was credited, but I had a line. The line was when he was having an affair with Anne Bancroft in the
right.
Hotel. And he really wanted a date with her daughter, played by Catherine Moss. And when he took her out, he said, "Where would you like to go?" She said, "To that hotel for dinner." And he had been using a fake name when he was using in the hotel with her mother. And as they came in the front door, the first bellhop that walked by was me. And I said, "Nice to see you, Mr. Gladstone." And
I didn't get credit for it. Oh, that must have felt terrible. It must have felt like your father had some influence over these people.
I made $100 and working after.
When was it that you when did you feel that you had made it as an actor? There had to be some time.
I started getting little bigger roles. And then an agent saw me doing a play. And he was a bigger agent, better, more powerful, more connected, I suppose. And he started getting me, you know, two or three lines in Mannix or in one of the shows that was going on at the time. And I'll tell you a lesson. He said, "You got an offer I have an offer for you to do this role in some television series." And I looked at it. They sent me the sides and I looked at it. It was like four or five lines. And I said, I've forgotten the words I used, but they were wrong. And I said, I felt like it was a put down. Oh, it was only a couple of lines, and I felt like it was a put down. So I said, no, I don't want to do that. I'm something. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, when there are a lot of hungry actors out in this town, you don't have to do this role. You can certainly say, no, thank you. But don't say, I'm too good for this, or whatever it was I had said to him. And he said, I don't ever want to hear you say that this isn't good enough for you, because there are a lot of hungry actors out there, and you will never know how hard some of them worked to get to where they are. And you, what you can say is, thank you for the offer, but no thank you. And I never forgot that. And I said, okay, Bill, Phil, thank you. I'm please tell the casting director, thank you for thinking of me, but no thank you.
And then was it shortly after that you ended up, I think you ended up in a couple of really good soap operas.
I did. I got a job in a soap in Days of Our Lives. And that was the first really major role I had.
Oh, wow.
And that was at the, and they didn't know, as is the case with soaps, they didn't know if this character was going to work or not. And they said, we'll have him on a day-to-day basis. And Phil said, that's great. And the character caught on. And then they said, we'd like to sign him to a contract. And Phil said, no, let's not do that to me. He said, let's not do that. Let's just keep you on a day rate. And because if something else comes up, we want you to be free to do it. And I said, okay. And 2 years later, I got a call from a casting director who said the producer of the show, The Interns with Broderick Crawford, had seen you in a play and thinks that you're right for this role. And that became
what was it like working with Broderick Crawford? Because I can remember the theater I saw him in as a kid in All the King's Men.
Yeah.
And I just absolutely loved that film. And then, of course, in Born Yesterday, he was fabulous. So what was it like working with him?
It was a thrill, and it was wonderful. I had, by that time, gone through a divorce and had been working at a halfway house with some people, and I'd grown up, I guess. And Brod was a big drinker, as you probably know.
Yeah. Yes.
And I was with four other young people as young interns in this movie called The Interns. And Brod was our chief surgeon, who was the, you know, crusty older doctor, and a drunk. He'd come in soused and he'd be, you know, staggering, and he'd be hard to kind of get to do his lines. They could shoot him up till noon, and after that it was forget about it. And I went in one day, and after I got to know him, and I talked to him, and I said, Brod, you know, this is not helping you, and it's not helping us. If we like this show and we want it to go on, we need you to ease up on the booze. And God bless you. You're an extraordinary actor. And one of the things about Brod was he never missed a line, and he never missed anything, even off stage. When he's, you know, when you're doing coverage, the star.
But, you know, sadly, so many of them, I don't want to tell stories of them because I've been around them a lot. So many of them were desperate drunk. Yeah. And one that I loved, I don't know if you remember a comedian by the name of George Gobel.
Oh, of course.
He was wonderful. And Hal Cantor, who was a personal close friend of mine, as a matter of fact, behind me, there is me with Hal Cantor and Mae West. Uh-huh. We're having a growth of Mae West, and Mae called and said, I want John on the Diaz. But in any event, I was making my second appearance. Art Linkletter had a show called The Talent Scouts, and I was making my appearance as a stand-up comic. But in order to get people to watch the show, they would call famous people to introduce them. And in my case, they called George Goebel. Okay. So anyway, I'm in the dressing room waiting to go on and knowing that Mr. Goebel's going to introduce me. And the door opens and he comes in with a huge bottle of whiskey and two glasses. And he said, "We're going to toast. We're going to toast your first appearance here on American television." And I said, "Mr. Goebel, I must tell you, I absolutely love you. You are terrific. But you know what? I do not drink. And the reason I don't drink is because I saw so much of it in my household as a child, and I'm not going to ever drink in my life." And he looked at me and he said, "How can you go out there alone?" Now, in your case, you mentioned something about working at a halfway house, which I'm going to expand on in a minute. But you were around at the time when they had contract players at the studios. Didn't you end up at one of the studios under contract, Universal?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And what? And how did that happen? And what came of that for you?
Well, let me just finish one aspect of the broad story.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. I really loved him, and I was really impressed with his ability because he was, as you said, he was an extraordinary actor, and the drinking was just killing him. And so we had this conversation, and, you know, I didn't stop him from drinking, but he did, he kind of straightened up a bit. And the show was canceled after one season. And every year on New Year's Day after that, every year until he died, he called me.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
And,
oh,
and
my God.
It makes my eyes tear right now to say you. And he thanked me for caring enough to talk to him about that. And it was.
What were his last years like?
Oh, I'm sure they were. I'm sure they were awful.
Oh, my gosh. It happened to so many of those people, too. Now, the halfway house, the thing that interests me a lot about you, because I don't know where, I don't know what inspired it. Obviously, it wasn't inspired by your father. It might not have been inspired in you by watching the movies that inspired me. It's something that probably was born into you. There are a couple of actors who are involved in doing good works and using the prestige and power of their names. Sean Penn comes, I knew Sean very well for a couple of years. Mark Ruffalo is another one. But they did that after they were famous. You were still struggling.
Yeah.
What was it in you that made you go sideways to go out and help people? And what is the California human rights movement, which you were so deeply involved in?
Boy, there's a lot there. Well, okay. You you mentioned being under contract at a studio. We'll put that on hold for a minute.
Okay.
When I mentioned briefly that I was married to Judy and we were living in Laguna, and I was torn between the business I was running in Laguna or in Orange County and trying to still hopefully have a career, and finally gave up the business, put a lot of time in Los Angeles, and our relationship just shriveled. We broke up. And I was shattered by it. I grew up a nice boy. I grew up with a hard, as I mentioned, I didn't know what I said, if I said hard drinking with my dad, but that was a big part of it. Hard drinking, two-fisted Irishman, you know, and he was somebody I could never kind of get to accept me or act like he accepted me. I always felt like I was a failure in his eyes. So that had to do with my joining the Marines and a lot of other things. But when the marriage fell apart, I fell apart. I thought I don't have anything to stand on here. I thought I was doing everything right. I thought I was being nice. I thought I was being good. I thought I grew up healthy. I married a nice girl. Suddenly everything had fallen apart. And a friend of mine, I was swimming. I didn't know which end was up. And a friend of mine who was associated with this halfway house said to me, I think this place would be a good place for you. It would be helpful. And I said, what is it? And he said, it's a place where a lot of people with problems go.
Synanon?
Well, it was like Synanon, but not, because Synanon turned into a cult, as you probably aware. Yeah. It was similar in some forms to Synanon. They had junkies and people out of prisons and people out of mental institutions and alcoholics and people off the streets. And it was funded by the Salvation Army, actually. But there was no religious tone to it. It was run by a psychiatrist, a clinical social worker, and a guy who was a veteran. He'd been a junkie, a thief, and had spent time in jail, and then he'd straightened up, and he was really the head of the place. So he said, all I can tell you is you call them, and you go in and you meet with them, and you'll have to stand up and make a commitment. And I said, I don't even know what that means. And he said, give them a call. So I called, and I was really hurting. I was just in a lot of pain, and I was 27 years old, and I'd been in Marines, and I didn't know what. So I called these guys, and I went in to this place, this office, and there were these two guys there, Ed and Ernie. Ed was the psychological social worker, and Ernie was the guy out of jail. Had history of being in prison. And they said, what's going on? What do you want? And I said, I have a marriage and this and my life, and I don't know, and God Almighty. And they said, I'll tell you what. He said, we deal with people with all kinds of problems. And what we've found is that everybody wants the same three things. Everybody wants love, attention, and respect. What do you want? And I said, I want my marriage back. I want my wife. I want that. And I blubbered a little bit. And they said, what we've learned is that no matter what the problems are that bring people to us, what people fundamentally want are three things: love, attention, and respect. What do you want? Well, I want this. And I think back on that day, and it makes me laugh now, of course, but I was weeping then. And finally, I don't know how many times we went through this, what do you want? And they laid it out for me. And finally I said, okay, what do you want? I want love and attention and respect. And they said, can't hear you.
Oh.
And I said, I want love and attention and respect. And they said, can't hear you. And I remembered what George said about standing up and making a commitment. And I jumped to my feet and I started screaming, I want love. And before I could get the words out, I was weeping like a child, and these two men had leapt up and embraced me. And as I think about it today, it brings me to tears, but as I realized later, it was the first time in my life I had ever been embraced by a man.
Well, I must tell you a couple of things. First off, you were enormously, enormously lucky.
Yeah.
Not because of who you are, but also to whom you're married.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that a lot of wives would not like to hear how distraught you are over losing your first wife. Now, here we come to something that I think is a perfect sitcom. So we fast forward, and I guess by accident, you end up on MASH. Yeah. Was it by accident?
No, no.
Show had been on for 2 or 3 years.
The show had been on for 3 years. That's right. I had gone from, so we put the halfway house experience. That started the halfway house experience. I learned from these people. I worked with these people. I was taught by cons and thieves and whores and junkies and people who really all wanted love and attention and respect and didn't know it. So they stuck needles in their arms and they sold their bodies and they did terrible things to themselves. And I learned a lot. And I came out of that a person. And the psychiatrist once said to me, "This is not the reason to be here, but doing this work is going to make you a better actor than you ever thought about being before."
Well, because you certainly became that. But and then there's so many things I want to talk to you about. First of all, you had at one time put your actual life in jeopardy to do good. Now, I want to say this quickly about MASH. It seemed to me that you fortunately for us, you got it. But here's the sitcom. You ended up, I think your first wife worked as a nurse.
She did.
That's a perfect sitcom. Your ex-wife, who you're crying over, and all of a sudden you're working with her. Now, you end up directing in MASH, probably something that you've done for the first time. Did you do it because you were on it for like 8 years and you want to do something else? You wrote some of them. Right. I bet you probably didn't even think you could write them, and yet you did.
No, that's right.
Is that true?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's a chronology to all this. You know, after The Interns closed, I got a request to come and do a screen test, but not an acting screen test, just a personality test, kind of thing. Be on camera, and well, some people ask you questions, and it was about doing a television series at Universal with Anthony Quinn.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, and I said the opportunity to work with Anthony Quinn is something I can't pass up. So I went and had this test, and I got this job. I played his. He played.
Oh my gosh!
And he played the mayor of essentially Albuquerque, New Mexico. But I was his assistant, and that show didn't last for long. I knew it wouldn't. But I had the opportunity after working with Broderick Crawford. I had the opportunity to work with Anthony Quinn.
And Sword of the Greek, and.
Oh, my God, this guy. I mean, this guy was...
My God, he was outstanding. And I remember as a critic, I got a wonderful phone call from him one day because I reviewed one of his films, and he's so powerful on camera. I said, Anthony Quinn is only good in movies where he never uses a knife and fork to eat. So I got the call. Now, I want to sort of fast forward to... But you ended up making one of the really interesting movies with Robin Williams. Tell me about how you ended up producing films. Tell me about your partner. I think his name was Marvin Minoff. Okay. Because I think it was 1985. If I'm wrong, you might have met him. Right? And you formed a partnership?
That's correct.
Okay, now, at the same time, I would want to know what your family would think or Marvin, your new partner, would think when you say, hang on a second, there are problems in El Salvador. I'm going to go down to El Salvador and help solve some of those problems. Yeah. You put your life at risk. So tell me quickly about that story and why you put your whole career and life on hold to do that in El Salvador.
I started, once involved with the house, I started getting involved with the prisons. I started getting involved with human rights in general. I started getting involved with all kinds of things. And when I was working with Tony Quinn, I got involved with the case of the Pentagon Papers. And I got, you know, photographed being in anti-war demonstrations. And the show with Tony sadly only lasted for one season, even not a full season, because he was, as you suggested, just too gigantic for television, I think. But it was a fabulous experience. But I was under contract then to Universal. And then MASH happened because one of the guys who'd been a casting director at Universal went over to 20th and helped start MASH. And when Wayne left after 3 years, after the second year, he started to talk about leaving. They tickled the idea to me of would I be willing to come in. After the third year, when it was serious about him leaving, they asked me to come over and meet, and I did. And that's how MASH got started. But I was already doing the kind of political things you're talking about. I had been involved in lots of things up till that time. But suddenly MASH happened, and I was news, you know, people on a hit show.
But, you know, you didn't let it sidetrack you at all. I mean, you actually, I believe, saved a lady's life in El Salvador, let alone your own. I mean, that itself is a movie, for crying out loud. And speaking of movies,
yeah,
what you picked the film that you did with Robin Williams, right. Just a wonderful film. Was that because you knew the doctor personally?
Yeah, Shelley and I, my then second wife, Shelley and I went to Russia, the USSR at the time, with a peace group. And we met there. It was a large group of Americans meeting with a large group of Russians with the idea of putting to rest the notion that Reagan's idea that the USSR was the evil empire. So we were working our way in to the Soviet Union, and we met this crowd, and it had among them a bunch of wackos, a bunch of crystal gazers, and a bunch of new age types who were nice people, but a little wacky as far as I was concerned, and some teachers and some psychologists and a good bunch. And one of them was this tall goon wearing a clown costume, big shoes, big floppy shoes and long hair and a hat. And I thought, oh man, if these people are from Mars, this guy's from Pluto. And we sat down in a room. We were in Helsinki, Finland, doing a kind of plenary session to get to know each other. And a woman got up and she did this pitch. She said, I've come here to reach out to the hearts of the people in the Soviet Union. And I brought with me these magical crystals. And I have a bag of crystals here that I've personally selected. And I want each of you who is moved by what I say to come up and pick a crystal and hold it near your heart. And go into the Soviet Union and find somebody with whom you connect and give that person that crystal, and it will resolve the problems, the tensions between our two countries. And I thought, whoa, okay, well, you know, okay, but nice try. Next guy that got up was this wacko that looked like a clown. And he said, I'm a doctor. My name is Hunter Patch Adams.
Oh,
and I believe in the healing power of laughter. And he went on and talked about what he wanted in life was to create a free hospital, and that he thought medical care was way over expensive, we shouldn't be charging people for medical care. It ought to be free. And he said, and I brought with me, I brought with me a bag of rubber noses. And he said, I want each of you who is so moved to come up and pick a rubber nose with which you resonate and take it into the Soviet Union and give it to someone whose heart connects with it. He did this perfect parody of this woman with the crystals. And I said, I love this guy. I don't know who he is, but I love this guy. And I got to know him on the train and as we were going into Moscow, and we were stopped at the border by the Soviets for the Soviet military for the inspection, because some of our people were trying to bring in Bibles and Christian literature. I was trying to bring in stuff from Amnesty International, and they wanted none of that, you know, propaganda. And I looked outside the train car, and there was a line of Russian soldiers. And here was Patch out there doing gymnastics.
Oh,
and
my God.
Going up,
you know, he's so up
to each of these guys on. With a rubber nose and putting it on each of these soldiers. And I thought, this man is nuts, and I just love him.
Well, it turned into a fabulous movie, and he may be right, because when I was on the news with Tom Snyder in L.A., there was a professor at UCLA who got cancer.
Yeah.
And he thought that, you know what, I'm just going to watch nothing but funny movies. He got Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello and Buster Keaton, and he spent every day, 24 hours a day, doing nothing but laugh, and he cured himself and wrote a great book about it.
Yes,
you know, sure. You should be doing a one-man show. I'll tell you something. For me, the greatest moments I had as a critic and a theater goer were watching one-person performances. I saw Hal Holbrook three or four times doing Mark Twain Tonight.
Yeah.
And it was a standing ovation for me. And a famous black performer, female, Josephine Baker. She was 77 and doing her last show at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Just absolutely, you should be doing a one-man show. And then I found out you did two. You did one on PBS about John Kennedy.
Right.
Can we see that?
You know, I suppose it's available somewhere in the archives of PBS, but it never got much play, unfortunately.
Oh, my gosh, you must have been brilliant. And then the other one had to be Clarence Darrow.
Yeah.
How can you, and where did you do that?
I toured the country with that, went across the country.
And how did it do?
Wonderfully. David Rintel's wrote a fabulous script about Darrow, and because of my affiliation with, you know, my opposition to the death penalty and my work in prison.
Oh, wow. Was it ever filmed?
The film, no, that particular show was never filmed, no.
Why don't you revive it or do your own one-man show? And I must tell you, I loved your book about being an actor. But I didn't read the second one, but I wanted to ask you why you called it Of Mule and Man. Did you run out of the word mice? Somebody else used it for you?
It was a joke. It was a bit of a pun. It was because I did a tour of the country for my first book in a Toyota Prius that I named Mule.
Oh, my gosh. How interesting.
Yeah,
well, I'm going to have to get that. Mike, I must tell you, I could talk to you forever. I just love you. I love your stories. And
thank you.
My gosh. Just, I can't thank you enough
for being
here. Honestly, I can't. And what we're going to do, since we pre-tape this, I'm going to go back and I'm going to get visuals to lay over some of the stuff that you talked about. Okay, but I won't put a picture up there of your first wife, I promise.
Judy and I are great friends, so no problem.
Oh, that is wonderful. Listen, again, thank you. You are just an absolute treasure. And well, I do hope you do a one-man show.
Thank you. Actually, I've been doing a one-man show about a scientist, David Keeling, about climate change.
Wait a second. I know that you've done that. And you know something else that you did that's fantastic. You are one of the only famous personage I know who got involved with that terrible blunder that was Iraq, horrible in that documentary that you appeared in. I mean, people do not know of some of the magnificent things you've done, not just as an actor, but as a citizen of the United States and a citizen of the world. You're just amazing. But when I say one-man show, don't do somebody else.
Okay.
Do Mike Farrell. I mean, my God. You know how many of us can identify? You just open up and my father was a drunk. I mean, you know how many people would cheer you with that?
So, yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much. And thanks, Shelley, so much for whatever she does for you, because you're a gem.
She is a doll. And thank you very much, John.
You have I'm so delighted and honored that you were on my second show. Thank you again, Mike. Thank you again to Mike Farrell for just a wonderful, wonderful interview. On the next show, a man with a great voice as an actor and an even greater voice as a political activist. It was the last in-depth interview he gave 2 days before he died. Ed Asner on the next Talking Movies. Till then, good luck.